Welcome to episode 1465 of the 1010 Thrive podcast, brought to you by 1010 Thrive Ministries. 1010 Thrive, 10 minutes a day, based on 10 guidelines for abundant living. In the previous episode, Thomas finally received the evidence he had been waiting for. 8 days after the other disciples told him they had seen the risen Jesus, Christ appeared again in the locked upper room, this time with Thomas present. Jesus repeated Thomas's own words back to him and invited him to see and touch the wounds for himself. But Thomas no longer needed to. In a single moment, he was convicted. Thomas answered with one of the most profound confessions in all of Scripture: "My Lord and my God." Then Jesus turned Thomas's attention beyond the room, pronouncing a blessing on all who would never see what Thomas had seen and yet would believe through the testimony of those who had. In this final episode of part 3, Thomas considers what it meant to spend the rest of his life becoming that witness and carrying it farther than he could ever have imagined. Acts of the Apostles, part 3, chapter 5.
When I was in that locked room and said, "My Lord and my God," I became, in a sense, a different person, not unrecognizable to myself, the same habits of mind, the same disposition toward examination, the same preference for precision over comfort. But the framework inside which all of that operated had changed completely. I was no longer a man assembling evidence about someone I was not sure I could trust. I was a man who knew, with the most complete knowledge I have ever possessed, exactly who he was and what he had done. The Thomas before that room and the Thomas after it are, in some meaningful sense, two people. The twin is myself. And the Thomas after that room went somewhere the Thomas before it could never have imagined going. After the resurrection, after Pentecost, after the church in Jerusalem began to take shape under James's steady hand, the question for those of us who were not called to stay was, where? Peter went north and west. Paul went everywhere with the relentless energy of a man making up for lost time. Philip went to Samaria and then met an Ethiopian court official on the road. The movement spread outward from Jerusalem like something released under pressure, finding every crack and gap in the world's resistance. I went east. I was given the assignment to go to India. At first, I did not want to go. That seemed an improbable destination. But then, in a vision, I was again told to go. And the instruction was simple enough that even a man of my disposition could not find a logical objection to it.
Go. I will be with you.
I have examined that promise for 30 years on Indian soil and have not found a crack in it. I want to tell you what it is like to bring a testimony to a place where no one has any category for it. In Judea and Galilee, I was working within a tradition. The people I spoke to had the Torah, the prophets, the Psalms, the long inheritance of expectation. I could say, "Remember what Isaiah said. Remember what the prophets promised," and the words landed in prepared soil. The testimony was completing a story people already knew they were inside. In India, I had none of that. What I had was the thing itself, the event. The man I had followed, the tomb I had watched, the locked room, the wounds offered, and the confession made. I had the thing that the tradition in Judea had been pointing toward, and here there was no pointing tradition, only the thing itself, and people who had never heard of it, and the question of whether it could be received without the preparation. It could. That is the thing that still astonishes me, decades later, on the other side of the world from where I started. The truth did not require the tradition as its container. The tradition had been useful, enormously useful, for those of us who came to it through Israel's story. But the truth was not the property of that story. It was available to anyone who would receive it, in any language, in any culture, with any prior framework or none at all. He had said, "No one comes to the Father except through me." Not, "No one comes to the Father except through the traditions of Israel, except through circumcision, except through the Torah. Through me." The way was a person. And a person can cross any border that exists. I have watched him cross them. I have been his instrument in some of the crossing. The twin who went to the far country, and found, to his carefully examined astonishment, that the far country was not as far as it had seemed. People have been asking me about doubt for as long as I have been traveling. They hear the story, the 8 days, the locked room, the demand for the wounds, and they come to me with their own unresolved questions, their own evidence that does not yet cohere, their own contradictions they cannot reconcile. And they want to know, what do I do with this? How do I hold a faith I have not yet finished examining? I tell them what I know. Doubt is not the opposite of faith. It is one of faith's instruments, a tool for clearing away what cannot be trusted so that what can be trusted stands more clearly. A man who has never doubted has also never examined, and a faith that has never been examined is held by its possessor but does not yet possess its possessor. The difference matters. It matters enormously. What I was doing in those 8 days was not the absence of faith. It was the active pursuit of the conditions under which faith could be genuine. I was not willing to believe a thing that was not true. That is not a deficiency. It is, I would argue, a form of respect for the truth itself. You do not honor truth by accepting poor evidence for it. You honor it by demanding that the evidence be adequate. And when the evidence is adequate, when the conclusion is secure, when the thing you have been holding in the light has been turned from every angle and has not cracked, then you believe it all the way through, with no soft center, with nothing left over that has not been tested. That is the faith I have. It is not the faith of a man who has never struggled with it. It is the faith of a man who struggled with it in a locked room for 8 days and came out the other side knowing exactly what he holds and why. I would not exchange it for any other kind. My name means twin. I have told you the various ways that name has attached itself to my life and my story, but there is one more. He said, "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." He was looking past me, past the room, toward everyone who would come after, toward you, toward every person, across every century, who would have to receive this testimony secondhand and decide what to do with it. In that sense, every believer who has never been in a locked room in Jerusalem is my twin. We are all working with testimony rather than presence. We are all holding the conclusion, at one remove from direct experience, turning it in the light, looking for the crack. The difference is that I was there, I was in the room. I have direct knowledge of what I am testifying to, and I have spent the remainder of my life carrying it as carefully as I know how, across deserts and oceans and language barriers and every kind of human boundary. And I have done that and taken it seriously, because he said, "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe." And the only way to honor that blessing is to be a faithful witness and provide faithful testimony for the people it was spoken over. So I went to India, and I examined what I found, and I have not found a crack in any of it. The twin went to the far country and discovered that the far country was not beyond the reach of the truth he carried. Nothing is.
This has been Acts of the Apostles, Part 3, Thomas, the Twin. The story of a man who would not believe a thing that was not true, and who discovered, in a locked room on the eighth day, that the most extraordinary thing he had ever examined was also the most real. He asked the uncomfortable question. He was met in it. He carried the answer to the far country. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. That blessing was spoken for you. Thomas reminds us that the purpose of encountering truth is not merely to possess it, it is to carry it. The man who once refused to believe on the testimony of others eventually devoted his life to becoming a trustworthy witness for people who would never have the opportunity he received. The same Thomas who needed Jesus to meet him in a locked room would, according to ancient tradition, cross oceans and cultures so that people far from Jerusalem could encounter the Christ he had come to know. Perhaps that is one of the beautiful ironies of grace. God does not merely work around the parts of us that seem inconvenient to faith. He can redeem them for his purposes. Thomas's questions became the foundation of his certainty. His careful examination made his testimony stronger. His insistence on truth prepared him to carry that truth into places where the familiar supports of his own religious tradition were absent. The skeptic became a witness precisely because he knew the difference between something he merely hoped was true and something he had become convinced was true. We may not have stood in Thomas's locked room, but we stand within the blessing Jesus pronounced there. We are among those who have not seen and yet are invited to believe. And once we believe, we inherit Thomas's responsibility as well as his blessing to become faithful witnesses for those who come after us. Somewhere beyond the borders of our comfort is someone who has not yet heard. Somewhere beyond the questions we have already answered are people still asking their own. The truth Thomas discovered could cross every border he encountered. It still can. Nothing is beyond its reach. Join us next week for part 4 of Acts of the Apostles, which will focus on the life of Andrew, the brother of Simon Peter.